Bill Resnick is up next on our program with a second of a two-part interview with Catherine Sammy, who teaches sexuality, gender studies, and history at the U of Irvine, California, University of California at Irvine, and writes on and supports the struggles of Iranian women. Bill?
Hi, Catherine Sammy. Welcome back to KABU.
Yeah.
Last week, we did an interview with you on contemporary Iran, particularly the struggles of women. You visited Iran, written on it, and keep up, especially with events in Iran and the struggles in Iran. Let's talk about the women's movement. Women in Iran have been struggling. In fact, even the Quran is so interesting with regard to the passages on women. Let's talk about the stages of the women's movement in Iran.
Well, I mean, I would say it's, you know, the past century has seen different kinds of mobilizations. I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, women were very active in the Constitutional Revolution. They were active under the Pahlavi era, you know, the Shah's father, and then under the Shah, you know, sort of mid-century, there were independent sort of women's groups, but a lot of the kind of main activism came from more of the big feminist organization associated with the state, the Women's Organization of Iran. So yeah, it has a long history of different kinds of feminist mobilization and discourse and sort of activism. Women were very, very involved in the Iranian Revolution, you know, like many people. I mean, it's a very broad-based revolution of women and students and workers and urban and rural. So it was a popular revolution.
This was in
1979. Against the Shah, against the political corruption and economic corruption. You know, the Shah had, you know, as someone very tied to the West, had really produced wealth and political and educational opportunities for more elite sectors of society. So many people were struggling economically and politically. There was a tremendous amount of political repression under the Shah, we should not forget. So the political repression did not start with the kind of post-revolutionary government. You know, the Shah had a secret police and many activists were tortured and killed in prison. So this is something that's been happening for a long time, not in, only in the last 40 years. So the revolution really threw off the monarchy, threw off the relationship of this neocolonial relationship with the West, and it really was a kind of about economic, political, ideological independence and freedom and carving a path that was not about the West, and it was also not about orienting towards the communist East, quote unquote. Although many activists and people who were involved in the revolution were, you know, Marxists. Some identified, you know, with different Marxist currents, some with revolutionary Islamist or Islamic currents, some secular. I mean, it's very broad-based, and women were really feminists, and different kinds of feminists were involved in the revolution. But after the revolution, you know, Khomeini consolidated his power, and women's equality was really framed in sort of gender differentiated terms. So, you know, that Khomeini's discourse became about women's equality through their role in the family and thinking of women as central to the establishment of a new society, but in sort of more traditional terms. And so women really fought that. They spoke back to that. They said that the revolution was about a certain level of participation. We participated in this revolution. We were promised equality. And now what's happened is we've been barred from certain occupations, and our status under the law is secondary, and this is not what we struggled for. And so really, in some ways, the revolution in the post-revolutionary period was very contradictory or paradoxical. It gave women access to education, enabled their participation in society, and also, as I said last week, many women entered education and entered occupations and entered sort of public life in new kinds of ways, women who under the Shah had not been as publicly present. So the revolution really provided that, and yet the state did crack down on some activism and also legislated women's inequality in terms of their status under the law. So they were not able to get divorces as easily as their husbands, were not able to have custody of their children as easily. You know, they have to have permission from their fathers or travel, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of discriminatory legal structure. And women became very incensed about this and so really tried to organize in the 90s with the reform movement that brought President Khatami, the reform president, into power.
Through an election.
Yeah, through an election, first in 1997 and then again in 2001. And this is what's kind of known as the formal reform government, reform period. And there were many openings. Khatami was more receptive to students' demands and women's demands. And, you know, again, he was limited in what he could do because of the kind of political structure of the supreme leader, you know, vetting many political demands. Nonetheless, it was a period of sort of relative openness. A lot of civil society organizations were established and active. And women's rights activists were working with parliament. You know, a lot of women were elected to parliament. And the sixth parliament was kind of the most progressive parliament with lots of women and reform clerics who were part of that parliament. And so women's rights activists really worked to try to challenge and overturn some of the discriminatory legal measures against women and had mixed success.
This is your OMO Variety Hour on cable. I'm Bill Resnick for The Mole, talking to Catherine Sammy. Catherine, you've written on the latest phase of the women's movement. This latest phase that you've written about is the 1 million signatures campaign. Tell us about it.
Sure. So this was a really interesting campaign that was very active from about 2006 to about, you know, 2009, 2010. Everything changed after 2009 and the presidential elections of 2009, in which the reform candidate, Amir Hossein Mousavi, was expected to win and Ahmadinejad was reelected for a second term. And a sort of massive protest movement erupted in response to what was really a fraudulent, a stolen election. And that was coined the Green Movement. Green was the color of Mousavi's campaign, signifying green as the color of Islam and peace. And anyway, before 2009, sort of at the point of the end of Khatami's presidency and the end of the reform parliament and the kind of formal reform period, women's rights activists started mobilizing to change the discriminatory legal structure in Iran. And these activists started this very grassroots effort. They went door to door gathering signatures. They also held street performances or kind of street theater where they could kind of acting out scenarios and engaging the public and gathering signatures. And they were not successful in overturning the discriminatory legal structure in Iran, but what they were successful at is really, you know, bringing a discussion about gender equality in terms of kind of from a feminist perspective. And they also, I think, reflected a kind of common aspiration among many people in Iran. You know, times are changing and people are open to this idea that women should have equal legal rights to reflect their actual status in Iranian society. And the campaign really tried to bring that, the presence of women, the reality of women's high status culturally in the society, to bear on the law.
One final issue, Catherine Sammy. You've written the current 1 million signatures campaign. It looked to Islamic precedents for models and ideas. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, just a clarification, the signatures campaign is now over. It's not current. It was really active from 2006 to 2009, and then sort of everything changed with the elections and the Green Movement, and most activists now are very underground or in exile, which doesn't mean people aren't resisting all kinds of things, but just to clarify about the campaign in particular. But yes, the campaign drew on, again, it was, you know, not an explicitly what some people call Islamic feminism, Islamic feminist campaign, but I think about it as part of, you know, there's a tremendous movement of feminists in Iran in the late 90s and in the early 2000s who, you know, worked with progressive clerics to reform discriminatory laws within the parameters of Islam, within the parameters of engaging in the sacred text to interpret it, you know, with sort of contemporary understandings. And this is a strategy that many reformers use in Muslim majority contexts all over, you know, Malaysia and Indonesia and, you know, North Africa, Middle East. So yes, the campaigners interviewed clerics and publicized their kind of writings to say that you know, part of it was looking back to the foundational period of Islam, to Muhammad's time, and reading the text and interpreting it from, you know, feminist perspective, to say that there's nothing inherent in the text. And, you know, many scholars, African-American Muslim scholar Amina Wadud, for instance, and other Muslim feminist scholars, look at the Quran and look at the sacred text coming out of the Islamic tradition to say that, you know, there is this ethical message. There's an ethical message, and simply put, the message is that we are equal under God, that human beings cannot be organized hierarchically because the only hierarchy is between humans and God. And so as divine beings, we are equal. There can be no inequality. Human beings have the same moral capacity. They have the same standing in a world where humans aren't considered the most important creatures, you know. So simply put, that's part of using the ethical teachings of Islam, you know. I mean, it also has, it has very strong teachings about justice and about applying principles to contemporary situations. So the campaign was part of that tradition of engaging text with contemporary understandings. And this is, you know, what many kind of scholars and activists think of as, there's religion and then there's religious understanding, and that the understanding is a very human endeavor, and therefore religion and how we think about religion and how we interpret religion has to be flexible. It has to change over time because human history is temporal. So in that sense, it's very interesting. And, you know, many feminists in the Muslim world are using that strategy of, you know, really engaging the text on their own terms, democratizing, I think in some ways, really democratizing who is an authority. You know, that Islam and interpretation is not just for those learned scholars, but that because in many places Islam has been imposed on people, they have learned to engage with it and make it relevant to their lives. And so this is, you know, we could talk about this for a long time, but it's a really interesting way of, you know, engaging again with a discursive tradition, but also a tradition that, you know, is about bringing human understanding to religious texts and applying it to contemporary realities.
Catherine Sammy, the struggle continues. I hope there'll be another chapter like the late 1990s. My guess is there will be in Iran. Catherine.
I hope so too. I think that everything's unpredictable. I do want to say one thing for KABU listeners, and hopefully most KABU listeners already think this, but, you know, the sanctions against Iran are not a form of solidarity with the Iranian people. Sanctions, as we know from Iraq, and we know from the long history of sanctions against Iran, and we know from South Africa, they really target everyone, and they're really, they cannot be used in sort of human rights struggles. We have to be against sanctions. They're really deadly to the Iranian people. And so I think if activists want to be in solidarity with Iran, a big target has to be, you know, we have to end the sanctions.
And support the women's movement and the many other movements in Iran that are challenging the repressive state.
Absolutely. And this is also, I very much, along with other activists, think that we can't, the choice is not defending the kind of anti-imperialist, patriarchal, repressive government of Iran versus supporting sanctions. You know, we have to carve out a third space that is critical, along with the activists and citizens in Iran, of state repression, and also critical of Western intervention in the form of quote-unquote human rights programs that really are targeting the regime or sanctions. So we need to articulate a more complicated political politics of solidarity.
Catherine Sammy, thanks a lot for talking to us.
You bet, Bill. Thanks. It's been fun.
Right. So long.